42nd episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Caitlin Egan.
My name is Travis Sintel, and we have a special guest today I'm super excited about.
We sure do. And let's just do it. Let's introduce him. Who is it? Yeah. Who's our guest?
Well, I'll say this, and then you say who you are.
Oh, all right.
I'll say this is one of my oldest friends in the world.
That's true.
I have known this man since I was 2 years old.
Yep.
Old family friend. His name is Jamie Wax. He's going to tell you a little bit about himself, but we've been trying to get Jamie Wax on the podcast since episode one, I would say.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I've been listening to this podcast since episode one.
Oh, amazing. Man. Thanks. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Jamie and I have talked about films and storytelling for a long time. Jamie is a professional playwright, screenwriter, TV writer, TV host. He's on CBS The Morning Show now.
I cover arts and culture for CBS News.
Yeah, that's
across
right.
Across a multitude of platforms.
Can you give us two of your best interview subjects and two of your worst? Are you allowed to say that?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
How about just give us four and we'll decide which are which? we'll know what you're talking about without you having to say
Well, Garrison Keillor, I was very, very excited about, who I think is a fascinating guy. And so I'll just say Garrison Keillor as like the best and worst,
okay.
Because he was a real challenge and he thought they were going to send Charlie Rose. That's never a great moment to walk into as like some young looking dork,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like expecting Charlie Rose.
Oh no.
So I had to convince him, which is really fun. Like I do a lot of research. I'm really interested and curious about the people.
Back it up.
Yeah,
no,
come on.
Like you guys.
I listen to your show.
That's oxymoronic.
That's not true. And so I like an interview where you have to win them over. So I got, you know, four opportunities with him in New York and then in Minnesota. And it was very exciting. So that was both the worst and the best. It was the worst that turned into the best.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
You became Charlie Rose to him. That's very impressive.
I really don't think so.
Can I say, I've only just met Jamie. We've never met before. Although I've seen some of your stuff online. Travis sends me sort of interviews you do once in a while. And I saw the one you did with Martin Short. It was great. You seem incredibly good at what you do. And you've also, this is the second time we've had you far more so, I'll be honest. A semi-professional broadcaster on our show.
Yeah.
You're a professional broadcaster. The last one we had was Lights, Camera, Jackson. And I'm having the same feeling of like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing so much better than we do.
Do you know what it is?
So articulate.
You know what it is? It's the voice.
It's in your ear.
Yeah, I'm wearing headphones, you guys. And Jamie's voice in my ears is just resonant. It's
you guys are crazy.
No, it's expansive.
It doesn't really fills feel up like, the whole like, this is weird. Microphone. It doesn't feel like life, like I'm watching you.
Yeah.
There's a distance. It's wonderful, and I don't mean this in any way critically, but it's like I'm like, oh yeah, we make a show. Like,
well, you know what it is.
Suddenly feels like this is a show.
Well, Caitlin, the secret here is that we have refused to learn. What the difference between us, Lights, Camera, Jackson, Jamie, is that they speak in complete sentences, and it's such a simple idea have yet to master.
I have a point to communicate, and I'm going to do concise.
What you don't want to be is one of those guys who can only speak in as broadcaster. Like that's never what any of us want to be.
Lights, Camera,
that's lights.
Yeah, there was a guy in Baton Rouge where Travis and I come from in Louisiana. There was a rock DJ in the 80s and 90s named Michael Adams. Z98, Michael Adams. And I was on his morning show once when I was like 18, 19 years old.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, how you doing? Michael Adams. And we did the interview and everything he said was like this. And when they went off, he said, Jamie, I'm going to have to excuse myself. I had some bad Mexican last night and I've got diarrhea. In the same, but I mean like in the exact, DJ
same.
Voice. Yeah.
Oh, man. Being married to him must be an adventure.
I'd say so.
Yeah. I have that reaction to magicians too. I'll see them do a set first and it's pattern and sort of scripted bullshit. And then you think, God, I can't wait to meet that person in real life. I hope he's, you know, a reasonable person. And then they feel like patter the whole time, the rest of the time you know them. That seems like a really, really bad thing. So at least Caitlin and I feel real.
Yeah.
Right, guys?
We're all real.
Yeah, we're real guys.
This is real guys.
We're real guys. We make bad sentence construction.
Here's the other thing. And we didn't talk about this and I don't know how to proceed, but this is the other second timer thing that we have going on this episode is Jamie doesn't know what movie we're watching.
Yeah,
I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, Jamie and I are working on a project. He came into town to do a Zsa Zsa Gabor piece.
No.
Wait, what were you talking for?
I'm doing a piece on a great organization called Every Table.
Oh, great.
That's a for-profit group that also puts the same food that's more expensive in higher-end neighborhoods in low-income neighborhoods or food deserts for half the price. It's really
And what
really
did Zsa Zsa Gabor have to do with that
because
organization?
Because she just passed away, Travis. They sometimes tell me late I have to talk about dead celebrities. So
during your piece.
That's another thing I do.
You gotta tie it in. Yeah.
I was going to have to talk about Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Yeah. In food deserts.
That's amazing.
But I didn't. But anyway, Jamie lives in New York and is here, you know, sporadically at best. And it's been hard to schedule him to get on the podcast. And I just asked Kaylin, hey, do you think he could come on this one? And we bumped up our recording for it. And I just thought it'd be fun not to tell Jamie what the movie was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love that. But you can persuade me otherwise. Let's do have a live conversation here. I want to say we should tell him because I feel like I have a lot to say.
I agree. I think we should tell him.
All right, so we're not going to do the thing that we did to my friend Dan where we made him sit and wait and watch. Because I had nothing really to say about Pleasantville when we started it. I have a lot to say about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yes. Yeah. Fantastic.
I have a lot to say about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
I bet Jamie does too, actually.
However, Jamie, I feel like this is unfair to you, but something happened that I just wanted to bring up, which is this is the Zsa Zsa Gabor element to today's episode of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Segue.
Nice. Yeah,
this is, very nice. This is justifying the completely untethered nature of this. Travis, this is weird. I don't have any other public forum and I want to talk about this and I want to process it.
I don't like
somebody.
What you're about to say, I feel like.
So there's an amazing guy on YouTube who's singing.
I know what this is. Right? Yeah. Actually, so Jamie, you'll like this quite a bit.
So there's a guy on YouTube who has been making a little bit of, hey, you know, he got a little coverage for, he covers songs, popular songs from the American Popular Songbook or, you know, just pop music in general. And plays a karaoke version of the music and then sings the lyrics to Smash Mouth's All Star and the tune to All Star.
I just want to pull one up.
Yeah.
Just do it while you're talking.
And it's so funny. And he's a funny guy and he's like kind of a really big guy and he shoots everything at this crazy low angle and he's got this giant neck beard. Mm-hmm. And he's done it now for like a dozen different songs. It's like John Lennon's Imagine, but it has the lyrics for All Star.
I'm just gonna
or like
John
Oasis Wonderwall, but it has All Star, right?
Yeah.
This sounds genius.
So yeah. Travis is going to play a little bit.
Oh, God. I just showed Jamie what he looks like.
I love this already.
Somebody once told me the world is going to roll me. I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed.
So, I would strongly recommend you go look this up. It's very funny. Well, we should tell you. You should look up the name of the YouTube channel.
He'll end up running Universal.
But here's
John Sudano, Sudano.
So I was very excited about this. It was super funny, and I was like, this is great. This is a great idea, and it's executed with this hilarious character, and I'm just down. And so I told Travis about it. Travis posted it on his Facebook, and people started commenting like, oh, this is great, this is great. And then somebody who Travis knows posted on there, oh, my friend did this exact same thing with Smash Mouth mashups with this same roster of songs in some cases, including Imagine, 4 years ago or something. And it really rocked me.
Yeah.
It really shook me the fuck up. And I watched it. I went and followed the link and watched it, which was, it's indeed. He took Imagine, the karaoke of Imagine, took the actual song Smash Mouth, slowed it down, and mashed them up. And it's like, I don't think that, maybe you disagree, but I don't think there's an argument to be made that this guy isn't thieving the idea.
Right.
It's a theft. It's an idea theft.
Yeah.
However, it's so much less funny than this guy's performance.
Well, because what you're laughing at, I would suspect, or part of it, is the image of a sad guy in his room doing this relentlessly. And the part of the joke to me is this guy is just like, he never sings it with any gusto.
Right.
He just sings like...
It's camera's
like,
in a bad spot.
It's a bad angle. And to me, the story is what I'm laughing at as much as I am the joke
and
of the song.
I want to be clear. I don't know that you agree with this, but I'm not laughing at the guy.
No, no,
I think he's
on
very
the joke.
Funny.
I think he's in on the joke.
And
for
his,
sure.
The setup of it, the performance of it is all so funny. So I feel... this is what I wanted to raise now with you, including you, Jamie, is like... And maybe it has something to do with nostalgia or remakes or whatever the culture is.
This is
totally
a loose tie.
This is totally loose
at best.
But I can't stop thinking about it, and I need to talk to somebody about it. What do we do with that? Do we have is there some sort of protection that we need to be aware of? Where it's like the unfunny thing that came first but had all the cleverness. Does that mean that this funnier version should not exist? And
it,
like,
this is standing out to you because it's the reverse of what we're used to with every Hollywood remake, right? Mm-hmm. They make the one that has totally. A certain chemistry you can't define and exactly the right cast, and then they try to remake it and it just, it misses. It sucks. It's a good idea, but it misfires. This yes. is like the total reverse of that.
Total
misfired
reverse.
The first time, and this guy's like, "I'm the man. I will step up and do this.
I will do."
And it didn't
this.
Even it didn't it, even misfire. Like let me just, like, to be clear, you watch or listen to the music. It's just music. There's no video. There's no live performance. It's just a mashup. And you think like, "Oh yeah, like that kind of works." That's
it fun. Just redirects the comedy laser. The laser's pointed in a different direction when this guy does it, because it makes it a character piece, not an idea. Mm-hmm. And that's funny to me. I'm laughing
exactly.
at the character piece.
It's, and it's all the execution. It's yeah. it's watching this guy in silence, waiting for him to start singing,
yeah.
and you know it's going to be All-Star. And it's funny every
it's
time
funny
he starts
every time.
Singing.
And also, you can kind of see part of his bedroom in the shot, which is really funny, because it implies there's this really, like, loner dude who's decided to make it his mission to record every song in the world as Smash Mouth All-Star in his bedroom, sadly.
Like, you keep saying sad. He thinks it's hilarious, but the
no,
performance
but the
is
but yeah, there's yeah, not yeah. a lot of joy yeah, in yeah, the performing yeah. of it.
Which,
right.
which I think
right.
is intentional.
Which
he
is,
makes it seem like a sad guy.
And the way
guy.
That he sings is great, because every time it comes on, somebody, like the flat, it's perfect. Yeah. And so I really am having a yeah. like internal yeah. crisis about this, because I want to value original ideas.
Yeah.
I guess he should have said, like, a guy did this, I guess.
But then it's not yeah. as funny. It's
I
not
agree.
As funny.
I totally agree.
It's not as funny if he credits it. It doesn't ruin it, but it's, do you agree it's not as funny?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a weird zone, right? It's YouTube. It's self-published work. So is it the same as that? Do you have to say that? If he did it funnier and more people watch it,
yeah.
it's sort of his. He sort of owns it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, you know, when I was working in stand-up comedy clubs, I mean, if you had the same bit as someone, or even if they stole it from you, it was whoever did it on TV first.
Right.
It
well,
was
that's
theirs.
Certainly the way old yeah. comedy worked, and yeah. they were quite open about it. All those guys, I mean, I only know a little bit about this, but like Milton Berle would make his career off stealing other people's jokes
right.
and just doing it better and bigger. You know,
did it on TV first. And that, so in a way, that's at work here as yeah. well.
It's magic, too. I mean, obviously magic has the same right. world. Is that there's all kinds of quote-unquote simultaneous creation that's just theft.
But this is, I mean, constantly. This is, but I got it, like, just a devil's advocate against myself here on this, because I agree. I'd like this better. I think this should exist. I think it's worth it. This is, it's such a specific idea to steal. And you know, that he's doing it live is the difference.
Yeah.
Well, are we at the point of views with this guy where he's making money off of this?
300,000.
I mean, so I think maybe that you are in a sort of a different yeah. area. This is not
and surely he didn't start
stuff.
That way, but it's you know, he got covered, it's exploded a little bit. I mean,
and,
you know,
and if he does 30 videos and makes no money, which he has no control over how people receive it. So when he becomes popular, now all of a sudden he's culpable. That feels like a slippery slope also.
And great. So at that point, does he have to say, you know, to be honest,
yeah,
I saw this
so.
Thing,
I
heard
so.
This thing.
Yeah, once he starts monetizing, I think, because now the joke's out, we get the joke, we've had a chance to experience the joke in its purest form.
We have.
Yeah. You know. And then once he's popular, he has to say, hey, I got this idea from someone else.
So if someone tries to get that money, I did this story on, do you remember for a commercial for a girls' toy company, they used the Beastie Boys song Girls a few years ago.
Oh,
I
do remember this.
Way.
So yes.
I found out, thanks to Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell,
right.
That the parody laws protect you more if you steal more. So you have to be really almost doing exactly what someone's doing, but not quite.
And then
for
you get
it to
away
qualify.
With it.
It's even more certain that
wow.
it's protected. So if this guy
wow.
claimed he was doing a parody of the other guy's videos, he's totally protected.
That's interesting.
How interesting. People versus Larry Flint, also in our bag. Wonder how that movie holds up.
Wow.
We'll
how's Courtney holding up?
Well, not well. I saw the other day at a nail salon. Not that I was there. I was walking by it.
Oh, sure.
And whatever. Listen, it's my life.
You saw her inside?
I saw her walk out. And I've... for whatever reason, I've met Courtney Love upwards of 200 times. for reasons we won't go into.
Is that on your
God,
resume?
Should have not even... I mean,
no,
I know that, but you should have not said that.
But we can cut it off.
That's going to make people fucking crazy.
Yeah, I know.
You have to deal with this.
But I walked right past her, and she looked at me like I was a complete stranger. And I was like, I cannot believe. And by the way, every time I met her, she was like, hey, my name's Courtney. I'm like, I've met you 175 times.
I'm in your
times.
Kitchen right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, well, yeah,
the fifth time this week.
I didn't come to the front door. I came from your bedroom
yeah,
into
yeah,
the
yeah.
kitchen, and you just introduced yourself to me. What the fuck are you talking about?
Oh, my God. Well, Courtney Love transitions us nicely into Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
I agree.
Terry Gilliam's adaptation of, I almost forgot his name, Hunter S. Thompson,
yeah.
book-ish, travelogue novel thing called Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you know, which is, when it came out, I will say, as sort of a way to begin, it had been ages in development. They made one movie called Where the Buffalo Roam, starring mm-hmm. Bill Murray, early on, which is sort of loosely the Fear and Loathing movie, or Fear and Loathing story. But they'd been trying to make actual Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas forever. And Terry Gilliam finally managed to do it, although not without like some unpleasant means. I mean, you know, this movie, Alex Cox was supposed to make it. He wrote the script. He was lined up to direct. One thing led to another, which I don't understand, although we have a mutual friend who does know the story behind this. Mm-hmm. And Terry Gilliam wound up taking it over. And he sort of stole Alex Cox's screenplay and then claimed it was his own. And there was a whole writer arbitration. Anyway, we're getting into the weeds.
It's a much better segue than you used to get from YouTube to this. You had a segue built in.
That's
you just
true.
Missed it.
And I forgot about that. until I started talking, good. Rambling on through it.
Yeah. It's weird that was actually an actual tie.
But one thing, I guess for me, the thing to set it up is that it was a real, I was so excited when it came out. I was so excited that this movie existed and was coming and that Terry Gilliam had made it, who as a kid when it came, you know, I was like 96 or 97. Mm. So I was, you know, 15, 16 years old. And I was so thrilled. And it came out the same day as Roland Emmerich's Godzilla. Mm. And I was like so proud of my cool choice to go see Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas instead of Godzilla.
Bats over lizards.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Although I remember the advertising campaign was that like go see these lizards because there's a whole uh-huh. lounge lizard sequence in Fear and Loathing.
Right.
So anyway, so I have a lot to say, but what was your?
I think this is a sweet spot for our podcast because I tend to generally know books more than movies, and Kaelin knows movies more than books. And this is an author I was pretty obsessed with for quite a long time. I should also say, is just as a side note, that we have a friend who's been shot at by Hunter S. Thompson.
He's a famously crazy guy.
Yeah. Was it a baseball? Is a ball or something. I won't use
who
the name.
Who are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. Okay. I don't know this story. Tell the story.
Okay. It's a guy, Kaelin and I both know, Alcee Allafair. But he had property. His family had property next to one of Hunter S. Thompson's properties. And they had a baseball or some object went onto his property. Oh, and they went out to get it. And then Hunter S. Thompson ran out with a shotgun. And then he's like, get the fuck out of here. And they turned and ran away. And then all they heard was a shotgun blast fire. And they don't know if he shot a warning shot or like what he was doing. But they never went back on that property again.
Wow.
But the idea, and I have the same obsession with King Kesey. I have a little bit of an obsession with Tom Wolfe, though to a lesser degree, because he seems a lot more
You
control.
Like some really difficult guys.
I like that idea. I love the idea of this. And to a certain extent, part of my obsession with David Foster Wallace came from that, although he doesn't do nearly what these guys do. But this immersive gonzo journalism, I find it so obsessively interesting. And Hunter S. Thompson is a guy just overflowing with talent and insanity in equal measure, and that's awesome to me. So I have an obsession with the subject matter mm-hmm. of the film, and I also remember liking the film quite a bit because I love Terry Gilliam also.
Yeah.
I mean, when you read that novel, it seems like it's impossible to make it into a good movie.
Yeah.
Because so much of what you love is a description of a still image or a hallucination that you could never imagine could be made cinematic. But if anybody's going to do it, it's going to be Terry Gilliam, you would think.
Right. And I mean, that was what was holding it back for so long, obviously, is that people were like, this is unfilmable. We saw it spectacularly fail once with Where the Buffalo Roam, although right. people have sort of tried to reclaim that movie. It's not very good, I don't think.
I don't think it's reclaimable. And certainly Hunter S. Thompson did not. I mean, didn't he want to punch Bill Murray in the face for years? Like, said right. he was going to kill him if he saw him?
Just awesome.
Yeah.
What a great feud.
But I would say that people would certainly still argue that there are people who say this is not a successful movie. When it came out, it was dismissed, widely panned, I would mm-hmm. say. It was not celebrated as a great film. And one of the things I really want to use this particular movie in this conversation to talk about is, and we did a little bit on Halloween 3, but this is a slightly different category, is Reclamation, or a movie that is sort of a little bit dismissed when it comes out, and its kind of power to stay relevant as it's processed over decades. You know, I mean, the movies that I would think of in this category are like Blade Runner, or maybe in some ways Brazil, although people loved that at the time, but it's sort of kept relevant by people continuing to love it and find it, discover it, reclaim it. And that, when I think of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I don't think of it as an old movie.
Yeah, it feels relevant.
Especially in compared to other films from this era that we've watched.
Yeah, and I think also for me, I'm trying to put myself where I was at the time, but Usual Suspects had come out 2 or 3 years before, am I right?
Maybe even right
because
right
I remember
there.
Benicio del Toro coming off of that into this.
You're right.
And he had made this wacky, wild choice for Usual Suspects of basically being incomprehensible as a breakout role and to American audiences anyway. And I remember loving Usual Suspects or thinking it was really interesting. And then coming into this, and I just thought, this is so wacky for like a young high school student to see. Like, it felt so wild to me. I remember thinking, like, what is happening here? This is great. But the guys who made it have all gone on to be powerhouses. Benicio del Toro, Johnny Depp obviously already was a powerhouse, but and Terry Gilliam, the pedigree of the film is like pretty top notch, and so that makes me think it's gonna still be good. I mean, you haven't seen it recently, right?
I have. I've seen it. I mean, within the last 5-6 years.
You're a cheater.
Jamie? I'm not a cheater. What is your experience with it, Jamie?
I saw it in the theater with a friend. Actually, with the same guy who owned a comedy club where I got my very first opportunity to do professional stand-up. And he gave it to me on my 18th birthday as a book, along with Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut.
Awesome. That guy's cool.
He was a cool guy. Yeah. Except for like the 80s, and there was a lot of cocaine around stand-up clubs, and I watched it do terrible things to people's lives, which was really helpful. You know, don't shelter your kids from drugs. Let them hang around people who do a lot of it, and they'll, you know.
Kalen doesn't shelter his child at all, we've learned in this podcast.
Yes, that's right. That's a recurring thing.
He doesn't want them to do heroin, so he showed him Trainspotting.
There you go. I mean, that's not bad.
Zero. Yeah,
he didn't want
really
him to crawl on the ceiling either. So he won't do that. But
that's the lesson,
Dallas. Really, don't crawl.
This is what happens.
This is the takeaway. But I find that the movie, I liked the movie a lot. I really did. But all we did was go out and drink and talk about how much better the book was. I mean, that's just what you do, right? Years later, I rediscovered it on cable. What I think happened, like, you guys are exactly the right age. People in their mid to late 30s really love this movie because I think what happened was when everybody was getting, of your generation, was going into college and getting to a real experimental phase, it was running all the time on cable. Ran it all the time on premium cable. And it's like the films that you mentioned, and even like, like Frank Darabont's movies, I mean, that you discover because they're run forever on cable, and maybe they didn't get as much attention in the beginning. I think your generation was just the right age to feel really like cool and adult to see this movie when it was running all the time, and you guys were in your late teens, early 20s.
Yeah, that's right. It's also the idea of possibility at that age. If you're 17, 18, 19, which is kind of around where I was, you know, you don't know what you want to do yet. You don't know what you want to be yet. But the idea of adults being transgressive against the stereotypes of what society expects and making it work for them, and the idea that genius trumps everything, is a very appealing idea for a 17, 18-year-old.
Well, that's true. But the thing that I think we have to acknowledge about Fear and Loathing is that it feels completely out of step with a 90s generation, at least at first glance. I mean, this is about the end of the 60s counterculture. I mean, that's what the story is, and very explicitly so, even in the film. I mean, they sort of talk about, you know, this beautiful passage about the wave crashing, and you can see the line where the 60s ended, basically, and all this interesting stuff, which is not directly applicable to the 90s. And when I think about the movies from the 90s that I loved, which are like Pulp Fiction, and the, you know, if that's the movie that defined the decade, Fear and Loathing feels like it has nothing to do with that movie. And they're both extraordinarily dangerous, but Pulp Fiction is postmodern, is fun, and I don't think this movie is that at all. And it's really mean and dangerous and weird and I think at the time even unpleasant. And you know, one thing I often say about Terry Gilliam's movies for me is that they can be difficult to watch, and I mean that literally. Watching them is hard. I find it to be very hard work to watch Terry Gilliam's movies because they are so chock full of stuff.
Absolutely.
And they're not very well, they're beautiful and incredible, but they're not traditionally orchestrated. They're just chaotic. And you have to kind of sort through it, and it's bewildering. And so when I think of this movie, I think of it as being simultaneously way ahead of the time and way in it preceding the time. It doesn't feel of that moment to me, which maybe is part of why I think of it as such a like relevant contemporary mm-hmm. movie. I feel like, and I mean, Pulp Fiction is my favorite movie. This feels newer to me than Pulp Fiction. And
same.
Well, yeah, it's same. Not commenting on a genre. There's nothing ironic about this film outside of what's ironic in the story
itself. That's really true. That's really true.
And Pulp Fiction, it's so much of that, the movies made at that point in the 90s were commenting on a whole genre or something cultural. And there was a sort of irony in the performances and in the execution. This movie is not like that.
Mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. think that's actually the smartest thing we could say before we start watching the movie, because you're totally right, is that for as wild and crazy, I think when it came out, people were not expecting something that was fundamentally sincere and fundamentally questing and curious and, you know, dangerous in all these real ways. I mean, that's what I think of when I think of the movie, is like, this is really like live and, you know, kind of scary.
Yeah. Digging into a character study as it does, I think is why it remains relevant and timeless, because Hunter S. Thompson is a guy who I think remains relevant, I would suspect, in the culture. I don't know if that's true or not as I'm saying it, but I think
it's gotta be true. I mean, I think actually some of the journalist figures that have come out with Twitter and things like that who are non-traditional, in a way, his legacy is way deeper than he even could have ever realized.
I think so too, but as I was saying that, I don't know who his standard bearers are anymore. Like, I don't know who you would think of as, because all the guys who do what he does, they're all neutered. And I don't mean this mm-hmm. as negative, but John Ronson's not.
They don't have his
He's
anger.
Not dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, Mary Roach isn't dangerous. Like, I'm trying to think of any... Foster Wallace certainly wasn't dangerous. He's
well,
a contemporary,
and everybody's
but...
distanced. I mean, what made Hunter S. Thompson so unique was his experiential.
And King Kesey also. I mean, it was mm-hmm. that time period. Yeah, I mean, King Kesey's around the same time period, and he was a part of the Hell's Angels rode with them and hung out with them. So there's a lot of stuff around that time. And Tom Wolfe immersed himself, but was never... You never thought of Tom Wolfe as dangerous. He's not going to go off and do some crazy shit. He'll go watch it. But
right. Like Studs Terkel was the same way.
He's
a great immersive observer, but he wasn't part of the story.
Exactly.
Right. Hunter S. Thompson was part of the story.
He was often the story. Yeah. He was the instigator, the catalyst of all these things. And I wonder if people remain relevant one of two ways. One, they inspire a generation that credits that person as being where they are. And the people they inspired become what that person was. So they have to do what Hunter S. Thompson did to remain relevant. Or they're so idiosyncratic and so centralized in the culture and so individualized, they become famous and relevant because no one replicates what they did. Mm-hmm. Right? It has to be one mm-hmm. of those two things, I think. And I don't know that anyone has taken up the mantle of Hunter S. Thompson.
I mean,
because you can't. It's not a thing that you can plan to do, right? You have to be that person.
I'm trying to think of someone who injects themselves in the story in a journalistic way, and the only thing I can really come up with right now is Michael Moore, who you can't really compare Michael Moore and Hunter S. Thompson.
That's probably the first time anyone's ever tried to do it.
I know, but I mean, when you do qualify it the way you just did, actually, I mean, as much as I said, his legacy is so strong in journalism, which I think is true, but there's not another like him.
Uh-uh. Hunter S. Thompson is not a role model. He's a really vile person in many ways. And he's very open about presenting that. And there's a scene in this movie that I'm most looking forward to, and I always am when I watch this film, where it completely stops being funny and they get really scary. Mm. Him and Benicio del Toro, and Johnny Depp and Benicio del Toro.
Like mm-hmm. that's the guy you're seeing truth. You're not seeing an attempt at a persona, it feels like.
Well, and this movie is a filter of that. So let's see how well this movie captures it. I mean, we've all read the book. We all love the book, I can say. And I think I love this movie. I would really like to watch it again and with all this sort of swirling in our head and see how it holds up.
Great. Before we do that, I'd like to make a phone call, if I could.
Oh, boy.
This is just a quick closure wrap-up of a previous episode, but I think it's relevant because Jamie knows the person involved. So stand by, and we can always cut this out if we have to. Hi, Mom. It's Travis and Jamie Wax.
Hi, Joe. Joe Centel.
This is my mom, and my mom knows Jamie very well. And, Mom, we're recording a podcast right now. I just want you quickly, if you can, to just tell us why you liked Mad Mardigan so much.
Why? How could you not like Mad Mardigan?
Give us some specific details, I think, about what... Because I you haven't heard this episode yet, but I remember very clearly watching this movie in the theater with you and you making me stay for the credits to find out who played Mad Mardigan. And I think I used the word salivate to describe your reaction, which I think is fair, if I'm not wrong. So can you speak to that?
That seems right. Yeah, I can speak to that because he's hot. The character is like my dream guy. He's like outgoing, he's funny, he's unpredictable. He's exciting. He had long hair. That's always a plus. He can make the best out of any bad situation, and he even looks good in a dress. I mean, what do you want?
So you remember – hey, Joe, it's Kaylin.
Hi, Kaylin.
Hi. You remember specifically that he's a great character.
Yes.
That is so interesting.
Why?
Because he's not.
He is the character of my dream, Kaylin.
He's that such a – one of the things that Travis and I sort of talked a lot about on the show, you'll hear, is like he's such a fool. He's like a joke of a guy. He's like so bad at everything he does. But Travis argued that he's not, that Travis saw a hero in some ways, or at least the attempt to present a hero. And I'm fascinated Absolutely. That you saw him as a hero.
I totally saw him as a hero. He got the girl out. He did what he needed to do. He did everything.
Joe, he took a love potion that like made him just abuse this woman into like him. And he didn't even like her. We won't relitigate
at the end.
All right, Mom. Thank you. I appreciate it. We just wanted to clear up some old business. Thank you for that.
Okay. All right. We're glad I
can help. All right. Call you later. Bye.
Bye. Bye, Joe.
Bye.
All
right. So does that make sense, Kaylin?
No.
All right. Jamie, that makes sense to you?
I know exactly the kind of man your mother's looking for now. I love the fact that like almost everything she said was a physical attribute. And yep. So you're like, I'm baffled by this.
What a great character.
I mean, she's just looking at the character the way men traditionally look at female characters.
There you go.
It's like,
that makes
she's
sense to
fascinating.
Me.
Yeah. No, not really.
He does look great in the dress. I love that she said that. That stuck with her. I guarantee you she hasn't seen Willow since then.
Yeah,
but she has this in her head. She remembers he was in a dress and she was like,
That was like a checklist. Well. She was checking off. Yeah. That's incredible.
Amazing. But it's lasted, which is really good. All right, let's go watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. We'll go right back.
Let's give the boy a lift.
What? No! Wait! We can't stop here. This is bat country.
Hot damn! I've never rode in a convertible before!
Is that right? Well, I guess you're about ready then, aren't you?
Were you friends? You're not like the others, man. Really?
No more of that talk, or I'll put the fucking leeches on you, understand? Get in. How long can we maintain, I wonder? How long before one of us starts raving and jabbering at this boy? What will he think then? This same lonely desert was the last known home of the Manson family. Huh? Would he make that grim connection when my attorney starts screaming about bats and huge manta rays coming down on the car? If so, well, we'll just have to cut his head off and bury him somewhere. Because it goes without saying that we can't turn him loose. He'd report us at once to some kind of outback Nazi law enforcement agency and they'll run us down like dogs.
Hmm? Jesus, did I say that?
Or just think it? Was I talking? Did they hear me?
It's okay. Just admiring the shape of your skull.
We watched Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and Kaylin says he's ready.
Travis, well, I did not say
you said, I am ready.
I said, is anybody ever really ready?
But then he
and
nodded.
You seem so ready. So that means you can start.
Well, here's what I was excited about. There's a couple things I am excited about talking about. But one of the things that we do on this podcast is we summarize films. And I'd like Jamie to take a stab at summarizing this.
And keep it brief, Jamie. We don't have all day.
Gosh. You really want me to summarize that film?
Yeah, like in a 3 minutes or under thing. One of the things we've made a mistake of in the past is having guests summarize the film, and it becomes a deep rabbit hole of like, and then this guy said that.
Well, we've fallen victim to it, too.
I've never once fallen victim to
that. Oh, that is a lie.
I am the most guilty of that, Jamie, but... roughly for listeners, what is this movie about and what happened?
If you had never seen or heard of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, how would you tell them what it was?
I've never seen Jamie more consternated.
It's tough. I mean, I would say it's a very bizarre and funny satirical but pointed take on a post-60s America where the drugs that were supposed to expand consciousness had now only become a lens on a meaningless... empty world with a lot of bleak, soulless people and too much consumerism.
Ah, so it's like an intellectual essay.
But it's exactly with lizards and vomit and lots of celebrity cameos.
Tons of celebrity cameos.
I mean, that's the best I can do.
Yep, it's great.
and I will say, I feel slightly hungover watching that film. I mean, it does. You know, there's lots of movies that they say they try to make you feel like you're having a drug trip. This has really got to be one of the best as far as making you feel like you've just been through something.
Just
kind
as
of
far
experience.
As communicating a state of mind.
The first 45 minutes is you get the giddy excitement of being on drugs and how funny and fun it seems for a second. And then you're like, this is weird. And then you're like, this is terrible. It just takes you through every stage of that drug trip at
just
first.
Just uglier and uglier. I mean, there is a scene where there's about, you know, 3 inches of standing water in a hotel suite that is just about the nastiest thing. I mean, it just you want out of there eventually, which is great, which is the effect that the novel has as well.
I don't know how to structure this conversation in a way that makes sense to listeners. I guess on a meta level scale, ostensibly the film is Hunter S. Thompson covering two separate stories in Vegas. And then there's drug trips centered around those events. One is a motorcycle race and one is a drug convention. And then it's just them bouncing back and forth and doing crazy shit.
I have a way to structure it. Because we talked so much in the introduction about the book and about Hunter S. Thompson as a guy, and we've all read the book, and I think I think we all read it before we saw the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And I, as a kid, read it in anticipation of the movie, but nevertheless, I read it first. Do you feel like this is a movie that had you not read the book or had no experience with the book, you could watch?
Well, I kept thinking that and watching this. I was like, if I came to this blind, what would I think was happening?
That's the exact question I had. Yeah. Like, I don't know that there's enough narrative in it if I didn't know it was an extended essay with just an incredible sort of Lost Weekend feel.
Because you don't really even understand. I guess it sort of points at the idea that he's on assignment, but that is not in any way front-loaded or tracked throughout the film. There's sort of loosely, refers to the fact he's got to finish his thing, and then there's some plot about the thing, and you see him writing on a typewriter occasionally, but not really about the stuff he's there to cover. It's not in any way the centerpiece of the film. They don't hang anything on that.
Well, to be honest, that was only that question was only a preamble to my real question. My real question is about movies that are. Because I think the answer is no. Like, you can't really go to see this movie, at the very least, without a lot of information about what it is you're watching in terms of the historical location of the story, in terms of who Hunter S. Thompson is, in terms of what that piece of work was. So is that a negative? Because how does that sit as far as this piece of art? Like, it clearly, I doubt very much that Terry Gilliam would say, or anybody involved in the film would say, here it is. Something that you can take instead of reading this book.
No.
So what is it? And is that of value? And what work do you have to do to appreciate this film? I mean, and I'm making a big assumption, which is that you guys like this movie. I do
very much.
So, but we like it and yet acknowledge that it can't exist as its own piece of work. So what is that? Like,
well, I'm not prepared to go as far as to say it can't exist as its own piece of work. I think you would appreciate something different about it if you bring knowledge to the table. But there is this fever dream sort of fugue state quality to this film that does exist on its own. And there are enough really strange pointed references. The use of American flags is like ubiquitous in this film. There's tons of like American flag references and there's a loose sense that this is saying something about the country we live in, setting it in Vegas and not playing Vegas too extravagant, which is a weird thing to say. Like the first 45 minutes of the film, every time you cut to real Vegas, it's just Vegas, and it's the landscape is so pointed and so obvious that Terry Gilliam doesn't really do much with it, and I kept expecting him to do that. And so there is enough in this film intellectually, if you know nothing about that guy, to just track it as some vague, unsubstantiated sort of allegory that feels like a fever dream. I think there's some enjoyment to that, honestly.
Uh-huh. Well, opinion. I mean, I... Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think that the movie is a masterpiece in so many ways. I'm just sort of in my head, I'm trying to sort of, this is weird, but I'm trying to reconcile why someone would make this movie. I cannot be more, I'm so grateful it exists, but this is a hard question because I love it and I'm so happy to have watched it right now. I'm so happy to have seen it and to keep thinking about it. But like, why did they make this movie considering the novel exists? Like, what is the effect or what is the point if not to, it doesn't take that book and put it into a movie and then it's like, okay, now you have the movie so you don't have to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Can I connect it just for a brief second to a different film we watched?
Sure.
And talk about it maybe, because it's around the same time. Do you know what film I'm talking about
we've already watched on this show?
Trainspotting.
Yeah, sure.
I thought about Trainspotting.
Yeah, can we talk about that for a second? There's something about, I always try on this podcast, Jamie, to place it in terms of the culture and the history and talk about what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And Trainspotting very much felt like a backlash in a way against the dirty underbelly of the 80s. The idea that 80s were so fun and drugs were so awesome and that you can party and live your life. And then Trainspotting comes along as well that creates some addicts and some problems. And society actually kind of sucks. And there's something about that time period that this comes out of that feels similar to me or sort of echoed in my head a little bit.
What's the hang? I mean, I agree with you, except that I kept locating it to its era. I kept thinking here, the movies this sits comfortably next to are, you know, Two Lane Blacktop and Easy Rider sort of, and Inherent Vice just came out, which is the exact same territory. It's sort of what happens in the post-mortem of the 60s when you know that you failed. And if you bought in and you sort of are now stuck with that cultural perspective, you just go to rot. I mean, like when you sort of realize, and I got to say the other, you know, this, you can't watch a movie outside of your moment, and watching it right now, there's a million things to consider about loss, you know, the counterculture losing, the counterculture feeling like they had the advantage, discovering that you didn't. And discovering that the whole country hates you, and that it's a hostile place now, that they sort of have turned the page. And, you know, I think it's a very different political moment than it was in 1971, 2016.
But to your point, the Vegas in the 70s was as far, if that's a character in the book and in the film, which it is, it's as opposite a character as San Francisco in the 60s could possibly be.
Totally.
I think it's a great screenplay in what they chose to use for narrative from the book. They were really selective.
Very selective.
But the moments like that great speech about the wave cresting and a couple of other great moments of narration, I mean, they chose really well. But to your point, Vegas and its excess and the fact that everybody's using someone, right, and lying to someone couldn't be more opposite than what they thought.
That's what's so interesting, though, about this film is that the I guess the essay of the book, it's the one of the reasons it's so successful, besides the power of the writing and the sort of linguistic gymnastics of Hunter S. Thompson, is that it's the metaphor is built in. It's just built in. It's drugs, Vegas, excess, chaos, bad behavior. It's all these things that you don't have to push on in the book, especially because it's built in. And what the movie does, it opens very curiously with Vietnam protests, right? And it sets you up for this sort of socio-political commentary film in a way, which Hunter S. Thompson certainly was that, and then quickly abandons that and lets the just action go crazy and lets the action drive the thing without ever pointing you back to what it's supposed to be doing, which the book, you can't get away from it. The movie, you can get away from that.
Go ahead, Jamie.
Well, I'm wondering if that's intentional, because sort of is his conundrum. I mean, what they're deadening themselves to in some ways, or at least he is, I think, is, was that all bullshit? Did that mean nothing? And in a way, you ask yourself the same thing about that as the film goes on.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I would slightly disagree with the way that you were painting the movie, because it does keep, like the wave speech, like the way that it sort of resolves itself by the way that it constantly uses American flags and the way that it keeps raising war imagery and the way it keeps raising the specter of Nixon. It's constantly locating you in the space of that conversation. It's just that they are defiantly avoiding talking about it.
Right, but not in an argumentative or linear or cohesive way. Well, it's a backdrop to the conversation.
It's a backdrop, but it's a backdrop that, and this is part of what I was talking about when I was asking about the book and asking about the necessity of going in with a certain kind of context, because it's, to me, watching it this time at least, the entire movie, it's almost a mystery. It's almost plays like what engages me is like, who the fuck are these guys? Mm-hmm. Like, what happened to them? Where did they come from? Who were they when they thought they were pure or when they were idealistic, if they ever were? And they've obviously gotten horribly lost. But you meet them in such a hyperactive state that you can see who Hunter Thompson was when he gets reflective, and you know, when he, you know, you can see him at his typewriter and you see like, oh, this guy has a brain still somewhere in there. But I kept being like, who the fuck was Dr. Gonzo?
This movie gives you something and takes it away immediately because you're there with Hunter with Benicio del Toro. He's fucking nuts. He's in a it's a crazy performance.
He should have won an Academy Award.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It is an incredible performance.
Yeah.
And right when they were sort of, I have a feeling he had an agent who was grooming him to be like a sort of Latin leading man. He's I'm going to get really fat and show everybody that and vomit a few times on screen.
A lot of times. He's so skinny and Usual Suspects. But anyway, so it does this crazy shit. And then about an hour into the film, there's a moment of perceived lucidity of Benicio del Toro when he's back in his office and has a Third Reich flag hanging. And he's speaking very rationally and calmly. I got stoked. I was like, I can't wait to see who this guy is when he's not on drugs. Yeah. And 2 minutes later, he's wearing a kimono. He's abducted a girl who has paintings of...
He's wearing a comforter. He's wearing a bed comforter that he's draped around himself.
It's crazy. And you're back to it. Back. And I was like, oh, shit. Like, I remember thinking, I really wanted some more time with sober Benicio del Toro to see who the fuck that guy is.
Yeah.
And it takes it away from you instantly.
Yeah.
You
well, he's just the spirit. He's just the dark, potentially evil spirit of what was always there. What you were always feeding when you fed it drugs and debauchery and free love, you know, like suddenly this guy is like there to take advantage of it. And he's going to live on into the '70s as the worst shadow of what the counterculture revolution was supposed to be, or at least told itself it was. And, you know, he's, what's weird about it is that he is wildly compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Like he is not, yes, he's monstrous, but this sounds crazy, but I want to spend time with them. Like if I'm like, sure, I'm safe. I want to spend my life with these guys. Like, I mean, not literally, but you know what I mean? Like watching them is like, I can't get enough of his you know, the things that he chooses to do, and the movie feels so mired in chaos, but like, I never forget. I think about this constantly, the scene where he's in the bathtub and he wants to be electrocuted to Jefferson Airplane, White Rabbit. And Hunter Thompson puts him down by throwing a grapefruit at his head. Is like, that's like, there's a human being somewhere in there, and I just want to spend all this time figuring out who that is.
That's really smart because the movie, you can track basic motivations, and if you unpack that motivation of wanting to be electrocuted to that song when it peaks, there's a real logic to that.
Yes,
that
you can track. I know.
Yeah,
exactly. It's so real.
I get why he'd want that.
I thought about that in Somebody to Love in this film. I mean, Jefferson Airplane's well represented in the film.
And I saw them last month, by the way. It was Starship.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is Hunter S. Thompson was so famously disappointed in the 80s.
Yeah.
That, and I keep thinking, that's the same group that sang that we built this city eventually.
Yeah.
It's God. No wonder.
I saw them play a free concert like a month or two ago. And
thank God
and
it was free.
Oh, God. And the lead singer of Toto came up and closed the show with them.
Okay, now this sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But watching them play all those hits in sort of one show is crazy. You feel like you're on drugs watching them go from White Rabbit to We Built This City with no sense of segue or irony. And so that, I mean, just as a side note, that band, watching them mash those hits together as if none of the songs mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're simply just like, here's a hit, here's a hit, here's a hit. And you're like, what? Slow down, guys. And then Toto comes on and sings Rosanna. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? Where am I?
Go ahead.
I was going to say real quickly, just so we get this out the way, because I think it's relevant and important. Cameos, Tobey Maguire.
Oh, my God.
This is where I was going to move
Christina
into.
Christina Ricci.
This is where I was going.
Harry Dean Stanton. I don't want to talk about these as they go. Flea is doing drugs in the
background. Gary Busey.
Gary Busey is nuts.
Did you already say Cameron Diaz?
Cameron Diaz.
What I wanted to talk about was this movie's location in the 90s.
Yeah.
And what feels, I guess what I was sort of circling around and didn't know how to articulate back then, and I think I can do, or at the beginning in the intro, and what I think I can do now is this, they fucking scammed their way into making this movie. Like, how did they trick Universal Studios in the 90s, which is not like the 70s when the studio system had collapsed? Like, independent film was going strong in the 90s, but this feels really expensive.
It looks beautiful amazing. For what it's ugly beautiful, right?
It holds up. This movie holds up. I mean, visually, it's not the special effects are
cool.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah. Not, it never yeah. feels cheap. I mean, like we're talking about, you know, we watched Jumanji not so long ago. This movie mops the fucking floor with Jumanji in terms of its visuals.
Never watch Jumanji again. Don't ever do it.
I think I might have seen it a year ago.
Please stop. Yeah. Go back in time and don't watch it.
Fucking thing cost a pretty penny. And like, so what was going on? And I can't even remember because I was too young. But like, what did they tell them they were making? And how did they get away with this?
I mean, the cast has to be part of that.
You know, the thing is, I mean, you've got to credit, you know, Johnny Depp has had his ups and downs in the news, personally, professionally, whatever. What a great performance, first of all. Oh, I mean, just phenomenal, brave, funny, like to be able to create a heightened reality where you can do cartoonish things and be completely believable is a really special skill.
I totally agree.
And he's able to pull that off here as well as he ever does on film. But he was also a financing magnet. He would make these really big hits at that time, and then he would go off and get the money to do things like this.
I guess so. I mean, what were his Edward Scissorhands? Like,
he had Edward Scissorhands back then.
He had Gilbert Grape came a couple years before this. That was a hit, right?
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, he's
Benny and June was a hit for Benny what it June, cost.
I guess. Yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah. I think it is cast, but it's also like, you know, the other thing I remembered that came out right around this time, maybe just before, was Natural Born Killers. Mm-hmm. And this reminded me a lot of Natural Born Killers this time. And just in terms of that moment in film history, I think it's, you know, people... I hate to constantly make this like the only theory that I have, but like Pulp Fiction rocked people's brains.
I think you're right.
To where they didn't know what the fuck they were doing. Like, for a very brief moment there... They were like, whoa, like, I guess we better get on board with this. I don't know what just happened or what just hit us, but that made $100 million. And so we better get on that. And we all, you know, Universal, maybe this is their answer to Pulp Fiction, which is like, well, Terry Gilliam's a renegade. This is a wild book. You know, when they made Natural Born Killers, I think they didn't know what they were doing necessarily. They just gave Oliver Stone carte blanche to do, sure, make Pulp Fiction, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And these really weird movies came out for like, 4 years.
It's not a bad theory. I in a way too, the budget's the big confusing part because it's a perfect marriage of people and material. Terry Gilliam was sort of made to do a movie like this, drug fugue state stuff. It's filled with imagery. I mean, Kaylin wasn't wrong in the intro. We could spend 4 hours going through the background of every shot and talking about the crazy shit that every frame 100%. Is loaded.
And it is, as you say, it's hard to watch in both senses in some moments.
Yeah.
But every frame is so filled. I mean, I'm thinking about when they first rent the convertible.
Yeah, I was too.
And you're trying to watch that frame by frame. There's like seven things going on in every.
And the angle choices are nutso and awesome and super cool.
I know.
But also to your previous point, you have two of the most charismatic actors working in those title roles, and that could be a train wreck performance for a lot of people, and it could fall flat for a lot of people. But Benicio del Toro and Johnny Depp are so charismatic and grounded in a weird way.
That's the thing. I mean, I know we talked about it earlier in the beginning, but like, my favorite movies are things that I cannot think of anything that they really correspond to. And I mean, yes, okay, we put it in the context of certain kinds of movies, but I don't know any movie, period, even like including like Fellini or something, which Gilliam owes a lot to, even named a circus act, the Fellinis, in this movie, which sustains so completely this, I don't know, like world, like, like they're behaving and performing in total concert with the imagery. And it always feels real. They feel like human beings and cartoon characters and, you know, symbols, you know, like I really don't know how this movie achieves its depth of humanity along with this kind of visual chaos.
It also never repeats itself, which would seem to be the easiest thing in the world. It's like you've got a sequence of bats. The bats never come back. You've got people turning into lizards. They don't come back. You've got distorted faces. It's sort of like as things escalate, the experiences are different for them and never repeat themselves.
Smart because I think a really big criticism of the film when it came out and probably still for many people who would watch it, is that it is exhausting, excessive, repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a huge misread. Like, it is not repetitive. Right. It is exhausting, no doubt. And they are always on drugs.
Yeah,
but
always.
But oh my God, it is, like, that's what makes it such a compelling watch. Is like, I mean, we sat here you know, we had to take a bathroom break, but like uninterrupted for 2 hours of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And it's, I could have watched it longer. Like I'm glad it ended kind of when it did, but it just kind of stops. It could have gone on forever because I have total faith that they would have kept that rate up. It doesn't feel like they've run out of ideas by the end.
No.
You don't feel like they've exhausted themselves. Like this life continues. This story could just go on and on.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing. What a sustained act of cinema. I mean, like I
it's also funny that the two of the few things they're legitimately scared of in the film are Christina Ricci and Tobey Maguire with long blondes.
I mean, can we talk about like Tobey Maguire covered it, like shellacked with sweat with a strange skin tone and long blonde strands of elfin hair stuck to his face?
It's like Toby Legolas.
That's one of my favorite images in the whole movie.
Yeah. So gross. Yeah.
And it was probably just him sweating through his makeup in the back of the car, but it's such a bizarre image. I'm sure Terry Gilliam was like, no.
Yeah.
Just
we
like
will
that.
Keep that.
The choice of that hair is unlike anything. It's just incredible. So crazy.
Yeah, it's the first person you see that's not our two leads. Is this creepy Tobey Maguire hitchhiker wearing a Legolas
Can I
wig
say,
and sweating?
Of all of these bizarre cameos, strangest cameo to me forever, I forget it every time see it, Mark Hamill.
Yes!
What?
Wait, what?
I saw this in the credits, and I was like, wait, where's Mark Hamill? I didn't know where he was. I saw him in the credits.
He's the guy in the sort of knit cap at the race that's at the bar. Remember, he goes into the bar,
Whoa.
And then he's on the phone again later. But it's like the strangest casting.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I saw him in the credits, and I was like, Mark fucking Hamill?
Yeah.
I
mean,
wow.
And this was
I still
like,
didn't know that.
This was
I've
not
seen
when
this movie
he was
a dozen
like
times.
An A-list film guy or anything either. I mean, it was the 90s.
Yeah, I didn't catch him either, but I saw his name, and I earmarked it to bring it up, and I'm glad Jamie.
Yeah,
Jamie
the cameos
did.
Are, I mean, that's something.
It's all cameos.
Do cameos have a role in getting a movie financed? Do they say?
That's a good question.
What if they just go out with, like, hey, here's the cast, and
right.
it's like all A-list superstars?
Most cameos.
And Mark Hamill.
And Lyle Lovett. And
yeah,
Lyle Lovett. He's in one shot, literally one shot.
Great to see, like, Terry Gilliam working with Katherine Hellman again.
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, I love that.
Oh, and Ellen Barkin. We forgot to mention
Ellen Barkin.
She's amazing. Yeah. Well, that's the scene I was talking about early on, which is now watching this movie again, we can get deeper into it. But, like, is that the only scene where you are really able to see them behaving in reality? So the scene is Hunter Thompson and Dr. Gonzo have taken a break from the strip in Las Vegas, and they've wound up in the sort of outskirts of the city, and where there is no casino, there's no gambling, it's just sort of shitty trailer parks and junkyards and stuff. And they go to this sort of all-night diner, and it's just the two of them in there with this burnt out, haggard waitress played by Ellen Barkin. And I remember some reviews, or maybe just one review that sticks in my mind, pointing this scene out, and me going in being as a kid, I read the review before I saw the film, and I was like really scared of this scene, because I was like, oh, this, they say there's one scene that gets really dark. And then when I saw it as a kid, I was like, oh, nothing really happened. Like, they do worse stuff and they're a lot crazier. But watching it now, I'm sort of, and that's all, but that always stuck with me, because here's what happens. They start making demands of her. They ask, Benicio del Toro asks her very aggressively for some ice water. She gives it to him. And then he slips her a note on a napkin that says, backdoor Betty, right? Or backdoor
Beauty.
Yeah, backdoor Beauty. And she says, what the fuck is this? Like, I know what this means. And he's like, that was the name of my horse. But it's not played in the way that any of the other film has been played, with canted angles and extreme set design. This looks like a shitty diner in the middle of Vegas.
Yeah.
And
it's shot
flat.
Normally,
yeah. And shot sort of upright at a normal angle. And then she tells them to get out. And he pulls out a giant knife, which we've seen that he has, this big hunting knife. And he starts stabbing it into the formica of the counter. And freaks her out. And then she says she's going to call the cops. And he cuts very violently, slowly, but scarily, cuts off the phone from the wall. And then comes over and stands really close to her as he asks her how much a lemon meringue pie costs. And then stuffs a few dollar bills into her blouse. And they leave. And something about the choice to shoot that normally makes them suddenly seem horrifying in the way where you could buy into the comedy, even though they are, and I wouldn't even call this movie a comedy, but it's, there's something wild but almost safe about the way that they abuse Christina Ricci and the way that they abuse the maid. They always kind of, you know, Johnny Depp is always there to kind of, he almost saves those moments because he then takes it up a notch and gets manic.
Right.
And that's how he deals with it. And he, in this scene, he just sits there quietly as Benicio del Toro terrifies this woman. So that scene, so, and then nothing else happens. They leave. That's it. And she's left sort of a wreck of fear and sort of shame of some kind. So what in your analysis of that scene, I have my own answer, but what do you think that scene is doing for the film as a whole and just in that sequence, and why is it so powerful, if you thought it was powerful?
I totally did.
Oh, I did too. I mean, I think the film loses its neon. I mean, that's an interesting thing, is the colors and the scents of pinks and neon are throughout this entire thing, sometimes really garishly, sometimes sort of subtly. And there's none of that in that. It's a gray scene. I mean, from the parking lot to the interior. And I think that that it's like the hard morning after. It's the moment of ugly, headachey sobriety of the film.
Yeah.
And also, it's the terror of who these people are and what they're escaping from. I think, you know, when you go into drugs, sometimes you do it for fun. Sometimes you do it because you don't like the thought of being sober. But there is a sense of this film showing us, hey, this guy's not a great guy. He's not funny. It's not fun. He's got some dark demons and shit he's dealing with. And like, the horror of that reality is very stark. And it's very terrifying. It's the scariest scene in the movie.
Are you suggesting that that is who he really is?
No. But I'm saying amidst the drugs, that this is who he can be and who he is amidst the... I mean, the thing is, we don't know who he is. We don't have any sense of who that guy is. Right. You know, we have a sense of who he is on drugs. Even the scene I alluded to earlier in this podcast, you don't get a sense of who he is. It's still caricatured. It's still crazy.
Right.
Even though he's acting normally, he's still nutso. And here, you know, this doesn't give us a sense of who that person really is. But amidst the rounds of 4-day benders or whatever, this is a moment of like darkness that he has.
You know, one of my favorite things, and you talk about compelling and how compelling that character is. You all mentioned Trainspotting. I think about Robert Carlyle and Trainspotting, and I think about Joe Pesci and Goodfellas.
Yep.
Like, if you can capture an explosive person where you get really, as just watching a film, you have a sense of dread because you don't know that you want to see what they're about to do emotionally or physically in this scene. It's really compelling. That's one of the incredible things about that character, is you really have no idea what he's capable of.
And yeah, you know what? That's cool. Because what I didn't think of until you said that was that even though he's totally silent, and even though the scene doesn't point at this, I wonder if the point of that scene is to see it very clearly through Hunter Thompson's eyes and to be like, you have to sort of realize who your bedfellows are when you've gone down this road, and you see him very clearly, and you get no such insight into Hunter Thompson except to think, well, he wouldn't do this, you know? And so suddenly he's kind of awake to who he's been partying with. And I wonder if that says something about...
Well, it does, because what follows that is his most humanizing moment. What happens is he gets... Benicio del Toro gets the pie, leaves the diner, and there's not really a moment of relief that you expect it to have, because the instigator of the violence has left the scene. He's left, basically, for all intents and purposes, has left the environment. And Hunter S. Thompson is reading the newspaper, which he's been doing the whole scene, and he looks around, gathers his things in sort of a... almost the jerk type way, just tucks his objects under his arm and one by one, then picks up the plate of untouched food. It's got a steak and potatoes and vegetables on it, and he picks it up, and he's going outside, and he stops and looks back, and this woman's still immobile, on the verge of tears, and he looks at her and goes back and sets the plate back down and then leaves. And it's very like a humanizing moment.
I was confused by that.
I loved it. I thought that's to me, and maybe I misread this, but that was the moment he was going to take the food with him to go, which is the drug instinct. And he's like, I think he thought, this isn't my plate. And he gave him the plate back.
Yeah, it's sort of the only moment he puts himself in anyone else's shoes in the entire film. I mean, it has any empathy for another character.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. It is
It's his humanizing.
What I like, it's humanizing, but it's so stupid. It's so pathetic.
That's what makes it so
great.
That
it's just returning a plate of food.
It's a plate. It's
the food. It's food that they, like, that goes to nobody. Like, that's completely, it's a stupid thing to do.
Yeah, he's not helping her in any way.
But it's the, and so it's not like you see him like, oh, you know, what a good guy underneath it all. He's totally helpless.
Yeah.
And he's totally unable to help her.
Yeah.
But he's trying.
Gesture.
He has a very pathetic gesture. It's the only gesture he really makes in the movie. So I think that's why that is there for him. I think it was a little spark of character development, of like insight into the process.
What is this? How did this? So something that we were starting to talk about earlier. How did this movie play for you now? And did you feel political reverberations into our moment?
I did.
I mean, today is, you didn't at all.
No, not really. Not really.
I thought I did. I really did. And
what you said up top made sense to me. I was like, oh, cool. I didn't really.
Really?
Yeah,
you didn't think about that at all? I mean, today is the day, just for context, you know, if anybody, when people listen to this years down the road. Hi, Dallas. Jeez.
Sorry, Dallas.
If you're hearing this, we must all be dead.
Today, the Electoral College voted to elect Trump to be our president. And again, I don't liken him to Nixon. It's a very different animal. But I did think, oh yeah, like that sobriety of thinking you were making a great deal of progress only to feel that you've slid back into someone else's country.
That was the only line that had a twinge of that. There's a line where he says, I'm going to paraphrase, but we thought that hope and belief was enough, or something like that. And it's that voiceover is laid over shots of protesters for the Vietnam War.
Well, what?
And
yes.
I was like, that twinged me a little
but
bit.
But the thing that really got me as I started thinking about that more is not the sense that, boy, this country was worse than we thought, but like, we never really had it. You know, it's that Easy Rider line. It's the we blew it sentiment, which is like, oh man, we like kind of lost track. And the idea that this movie presents that, frankly, of a word that probably didn't exist back then, of bubbles and intellectual bubbles. And when you sort of wander just over the California divide, this spoke to me, into Nevada, even a crazy place like Vegas, suddenly you're back in the country you forgot about on some level. And the idea that this country will snap back with a vengeance and a rage when you think that you're all good and you think you're kind of coasting, that felt very powerful to me right now.
Familiar, right?
Yeah, familiar. Right.
I mean, I got to say, the moment that made me think about the present political situation was very unusual. And first time it struck me this way, seeing this movie, is Chris Maloney's character speaking.
Me too.
Like the fact that he's a gay character and this kind of fascist cop, like a high-ranking cop who's on vacation in Vegas and is yelling at him with a lot of authority, but he actually is able to shut this guy's trip down, that's the only power he has. I do see echoes in some of the things that have been happening, like that there are people who feel more on the fringe and like that's the only way they're going to be able to speak to a certain type of authority.
And the camaraderie between fringe groups.
I mean, right,
like,
exactly.
The fact that a gay character in 1971 has such a immediate connection and understanding with Hunter Thompson, who's not, he's just a drug addict. He's a crazy,
doesn't
hippie
care
drug
for
addict
him any
journalist.
More than he does for the
But they are like, yeah, we know this guy's the enemy.
It's culture versus counterculture.
Yeah.
And they're, like it or not, they're both part of the counterculture.
Yeah, and it's a shared enemy, as you said.
Totally.
Yeah,
and they're suddenly out in hostile territory and they're sort of getting a moment between each other where they never mention it and they never talk about it, but that's their sort of bond.
Well, what's good about that is that the Chris Maloney's character tries to follow up on that relationship a little bit by calling to give him a message, and Hunter S. Thompson shuts that relationship down,
right?
Which is, I think, important to it. It's like, now that we don't share the common enemy, we're not friends.
It is a film about using people in a lot of ways, right? And the only time you don't use people, and except for maybe that pang of conscience that he has at the very end, is when it could get you busted. That's the only time you don't use them anymore.
Well, and so all of that. The other thing I thought is, you know, and a question I wanted to ask both of you guys is like, do you think this movie, how does this movie feel about the countercultural revolution of the 60s? How does Hunter Thompson feel about it? And how does this film feel about it when it sort of reflects upon it or depicts the aftermath of it?
I don't think Hunter S. Thompson, this may be incorrect, but I don't think Hunter S. Thompson sees himself as a sort of an agent of change like those idiot hippies protesting. I think he sees himself as outside of that, as a commentator on it, as a loose cannon amidst that. And I think that movie strikes that tone perfectly, that I think he hates both of those people.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could put self in the title it would be pretty apt.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a school of thought, and maybe you guys have heard this, I think it's been widely discredited, but I mean, there's a persistent school of thought that there is no Dr. Gonzo, that they're all Hunter S. Thompson, that this is like his id
riding along with them, and that's why people are always looking for the guy and he's never around,
right,
things like that, that these are all things he actually was doing and sort of blaming on this other character.
Yeah.
Which, it feels right. I mean, totally. Listen, there's a lot of echoes of a lot of literary traditions in this film that I want to go back and reread the book now. It's been I read it in high school.
Do too.
I want to see what I can pull from just in literary traditions, what's come out of that. Because I think stylistically you can point to a lot of Hunter S. Thompson influences, if not journalistic, you know, references. And I want to just take back some of what I said earlier. Basically is what I'm trying to say. That I bet you there's stylistic flourishes and stuff that exist in literary tradition as a result of him. Stream of consciousness types writing and like that kind of literary pyrotechnic stuff that he does. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people try to do that probably.
Well, that, you know, you asked the question, why would someone want to make this book into a film? And I think it's the double-edged sword of an author who writes about visuals or puts you in a place where you can see what they're describing so incredibly. And you think, I want to see this. Because film is a visual medium, you think, oh, I want to see this. And it doesn't always make it a great story or a great movie.
Yeah.
But you just want to see the images being painted.
What's weird about that is that what I thought to myself is, you know, I can read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and have a very clear image. You know, it's very cinematic in its sort of way of depicting a headspace or environment. And so you would think that putting a stylist as specific as Terry Gilliam on this movie would rob that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't find that this movie creates a poverty of my own imagination. It seems to be totally enriching of it. And I can't explain why. But, you know, it's such a aggressive visual statement and interpretation of a book, but it doesn't feel it doesn't feel like it crowds out your own.
Do you know why? I think to me, because I had the same reaction, because most if not all of the drug trip scenes are very POV motivated. They're very sort of limited third person shot. And so there always seemed to me to be something just outside the frame that was interesting and cool. And I found myself imagining a lot of times like what's behind him, what's to the right of him. Yeah. But it all feels so, you know, limited third person motivated that it makes it feel like you're seeing a crazy drug trip, but there's always shit outside the frame that you don't see.
Yeah. Constantly. I mean, it's kind of scary. I tell you, I had the same thought, and one of my favorite uses of that really made me realize how sort of paranoid in a way this film makes you while you're watching it is if you notice there's a low shot when you first see that the hotel suite is covered in water and he's got a piece, instead of just moving the camera through the water, he's got some kind of garbage in front of it. It's a creature swimming in the water there's something moving in on the character.
Yeah, the camera angles in this film are amazing. Yeah. They're so smart
and
interesting.
As you guys were talking, as I was thinking about it right now, I do think that maybe the answer to that, for me at least, and the reason it doesn't feel exclusionary to my own thoughts or feelings, is that it's not ultimately about the visuals. They're a really valuable guide or like invitation into thought, into a state of mind, into considering the implications of this. I mean, it kind of is an essay that you create as you watch this chaos. You know, I mean, like, I keep working on the movie. The movie really has a lot of space for you to work with it and think through it and get deep into what those ideas are that are so buried and so covered by this excess that I really think it rewards viewing, and therefore the visuals are somehow not limiting because they really open up everything that's underneath. I mean, it's a really brilliant movie for never saying what it's about, or very rarely.
What's so smart about the use of all the symbology is that when you load a, I think Mad Max does this actually. If you load a movie with symbols and don't always make it cohesive as to what they mean, and you introduce them at weird places, then it undercuts the moments you do understand. It just feels like it's the tapestry of this film. You know, there's moments the American flag imagery comes in. You're like, I totally get what's happening here. It's undercutting the previous scene. This is America, blah blah blah. And then later on, you'll see an American flag used in a totally different capacity that's just in the scene.
Yeah.
And it's constantly undercutting.
Sometimes they're huffing ether off the American flag. Yeah, sometimes it's just, you know, hanging off the back.
Which is great. It's undercutting all the stuff that they're doing.
Because
you're right.
Because it keeps throwing it at you and being like, we're not going to tell you what to think. Yeah. You're just going to have to deal with it.
I mean, the other thing, contextualizing this in the time it was written, was this a commentary on Kerouac? Like, if we had read it when it first came out, or even on Easy Rider, all everybody was doing these stories about trying to find the real America.
Yeah.
And was it, it was sort of a brilliant but sort of empty and cynical guy's satire of those things, yeah, and saying, you know, hey, look, here's my version. Ha ha.
I think you're right. And yeah, by the way, the other thing that strikes me about why this was kind of a failure, you know, a financial failure, which, like, watching it is like, okay, duh. But, yeah, like, also a critical failure is it came out in the Clinton 90s,
mm-hmm,
when it didn't feel like there was that much to rebel against.
Yeah.
And it that's a fallacy, you know, especially if you look under the surface. I think this movie will be constantly and perpetually relevant. Yeah. But at the moment, it was like, why the fuck are we dealing with this post-60s bullshit? Like,
yeah.
And suddenly, for me, now, for me, that spirit is sort of reawakened, and like I've been really interested in these kinds of stories, you know, lately, as this political shift occurs. And that's not so, I mean, I think I could have appreciated this had I watched it a year ago too, but right now it's like, it's a really powerful reminder to me that this movie, the movie separated from it actually coming out in its era, and reevaluating it 20 plus years from when it was made, it suddenly feels the most resonant I've ever experienced. That may be me.
Well, no, I think it's what we've talked about before on this podcast, because around the same era, Larry Brown's doing his literary thing. You have Tom York, you have Bret Easton Ellis, you have Jay,
mm-hmm,
McInerney,
right,
mm-hmm,
you have Trainspot, you know,
right,
Irving Welsh, like
this,
there's
like
a everybody thing
saying
here.
This hasn't actually gone anywhere,
yeah,
that's
right,
really,
a lot of people are saying what
good.
This is saying,
that's
so
smart.
I think it really plays into what we've been discovering as we revisit the 90s on this podcast.
I mean, is it interesting that we're also watching this in an era when heroin is at an all-time high since,
yeah,
the time that this,
yeah,
movie
totally.
Is set.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, this movie interesting. Barely mentions heroin.
Yeah, he suggests it one time, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
only one reference to smack in
yep.
this whole movie.
Yep, yep, yep.
All right, we're really far on time.
Yeah, well, what are you
going to
do?
I know. I wouldn't have changed a word of it. I want to ask Jamie Wax, while Kaylin gets the bag. We'll do a little wrap up on the film here in a second. Over there, where can people follow you, reach you? Is there anything you want to plug?
You know,
for our 50 listeners. I'm kidding. There's hundreds of you. We know that.
I have a play that we hope will open in New York in the coming year, called The Skelly Papers, and we are working on developing that into a film as well, which will be a whole interesting thing that, you know, we'll have to all get together and talk about at a
yeah,
later time.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
And that's it. They can watch CBS This Morning, CBS Sunday Morning, or our streaming news, which, you know, shows you our times. The streaming news is where I wonder how many people watch it, and on the plane, two different people said, "Hey, I watch you on CBSN."
Oh, killer!
So please watch CBSN. It's a
nice.
Kind of a great way to get your news.
And follow Jamie on Twitter. I'm going to get this right. MISTAHWAX.
That's right,
Mr. Wax.
I'm not a great tweeter, but you know,
yeah.
I
you
try.
Got stuff. You can follow. You can that way. You can at least stay abreast of what he's doing and his
that's
stuff.
Right.
Going
yeah, no,
on,
so. Jamie is very, very, very good at what he does. I mean, I heard Garrison Keillor called him the next Charlie Rose.
I heard that. Yeah, I saw that.
No, he said next, and then he asked for Charlie
comma,
Rose.
Charlie
that was
Rose?
Different.
Question mark.
Before we do that, is there anything you want to say about wrap up on this film?
No,
I say watch
please,
it.
Please watch
yeah,
it.
I say
I mean,
watch
come
it.
Come on, this movie shouldn't exist. And the fact that it does is miracle enough, but
yeah.
the fact that I find it extraordinarily powerful and, you know, maybe next to Brazil, Gilliam's best movie, everybody should
I
watch
agree
it.
With all those sentiments. Jamie, you agree?
I agree, except I also love The Fisher King, but that's for another day.
We'll come back from
The
Fisher
King. It's in
here,
pull
yeah.
it, and then we'll talk about
yeah,
it.
Pull right. it, we'll do it.
All right, Jamie is reaching go. Into the bag. Right. He is
well,
pulling.
Got
he's got it. Ooh,
he
it feels,
no, he knows.
It feels
he
like
deep,
it feels good.
Deep dive.
What are we watching next week, Jamie?
Oh, boy. You're welcome for this. The Brave Little Toaster.
Whoa. Beautiful transition, as always.
More drugs. Great.
Well, join us next time to find out. I'm curious about this myself. If The Brave Little Toaster sucks.
On Does Your Favorite Movie Suck?